Welcome to season two of The Empty Chair, a podcast from Penn South Africa. I'm your host, Nadia Davids, and I'm the current president of Penn SA. Every year, on the 15th of November, Penn centers throughout the world mark the Day of the Imprisoned Writer, and at each event, there's an unoccupied chair. This chair symbolizes those who cannot be with us because they have been jailed for their writings, and it is from this symbol that our podcast takes its name. Each of our six episodes is dedicated to a writer in prison or a writer who has been curtailed, harassed, detained, or tortured by the state. In this episode, we stand in solidarity with Selahattin Demirtas from Turkey. He's a writer and former co-chair of the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party and has been held in detention since November 2016 on charges that aim to stifle pluralism and limit freedom of political debate. He's been held in the Erdin prison in western Turkey, over 1,600 kilometers away from his loved ones. While in prison, he wrote a collection of short stories entitled Seher, which means dawn, which instantly became a bestseller and was translated into scores of languages, notably being awarded a Penn Translates Award by English Penn. His latest book, Devran, was published in 2019. He's an honorary member of German Penn and Penn Katala. We call on the Turkish authorities to immediately release Demirtas and to end all ongoing criminal proceedings against him. In this, our third episode of Season 2, Penn South Africa board member Bongani Kona talks to Tope Folarin about fatherhood, the American dream, his apprenticeship as a writer, his novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, also fiction, and the need to construct new realities. Bongani Kona is a writer, editor, and the co-curator of the Archive of Forgetfulness Project. He studied creative writing at the University of Cape Town and is the co-editor of Migrations, a short story collection. In 2021, he edited Our Ghosts Were Once People. His work has been broadcast on the BBC and appeared in a variety of publications and anthologies, including Chimurenga, Safe House, and Black Tax. Kona was shortlisted for the Kane Prize in 2016 and awarded the 2019 Ruth First Fellowship.
You know, at the heart of your project are questions of identity and reality, the construction of reality and memory, I guess, to some extent. But the thing that sprang to mind, or rather the word that sprang to mind as you were reading there, is damaged. You know, like the kind of damage the society does to this little boy.
Tope Folarin is a Nigerian-American writer based in Washington, D.C. He serves as executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies and the Lannan Visiting Lecturer in Creative Writing at Georgetown University. He's garnered so many awards for his writing, including the Kane Prize for African Writing and the Weising Award for Fiction. He also serves as a board member of the Avalon Theatre in Washington, D.C., the vice president of the board of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and as a member of the President's Council of Pathfinder. He was educated at Morehouse College and the University of Oxford, where he earned two master's degrees as a Rhodes Scholar. His debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, was published by Simon & Schuster.
We have a really kind of odd and constricted way of thinking about reality in the West. Either reality is here and it's substantive and it's something that I can touch, or it's nothing at all. And I think what Tunde is beginning to discover is that in order to survive, and I would argue this is the case for many people of color and women and other marginalized communities, in order to survive, we need to construct new realities, because the realities that we inhabit were not constructed for our benefit.
I had the pleasure of first meeting Bongani and Tope when they were both finalists at the 2016 Kane Prize for African Writing, and I was really struck then by how wonderfully collegiate these two writers, who were in fierce competition with each other, were. And it was really a mark of their commitment to writing as a place where both art and comradeship can thrive. Listening to their conversation is affirming in every way that counts, and it's fascinating too.
Tope, thank you so much for your time, and I'm delighted to be speaking to you this afternoon, well, morning your time and afternoon my time, about your exquisite debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man. But before we get there, may I ask you, how are you doing? It's a very large question these days, but how are you and how have the last 2 years been for you?
Gosh, the past 2 years. I was thinking the other day that it's just been, like many people, I'm sure, I do feel like I have a lost year, you know? A year that I certainly lived in and experienced like everyone else, but I was surviving, and I think a lot of folks were surviving as well. And obviously, I'm incredibly blessed that I survived and my family survived and we're all healthy and everything else. But it was a traumatic experience in many ways. But, you know, I guess in its own way, too, good for the work, as these kinds of things often are. You know, I have a few ideas that I think have been gestating as a result of my extended period in that kind of year-long abyss. And so we'll see what happens as a result of that. But I can't say that we're on the other side of things quite yet, but glad that at least with respect to me and my family, that things are going well.
And your family also grew by 25%, if I'm right. Do you want to say something about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my second daughter was born, I think about a week after the shelter in place order went to effect here in DC, or maybe a few days after. I could have that wrong. But it was a really dramatic experience for us because my wife had a difficult pregnancy. We were planning for, you know, my parents to be here, her father to be here, some additional assistance just to help us, you know, ease our way into being the parents of two kids. And then the pandemic happens, and it was just, you know, at the hospital, they didn't want to allow me into the operating theater for the C-section. I had to more or less argue my way in. The hospital, I think, is generally a place where you go and you expect them to take care of you and to know what to do. And it was really odd to be in that space and to encounter doctors and other medical professionals who seemed somewhat unsure of themselves. It was a really striking experience. But I finally got into the operating theater, saw my second daughter, and then we were at the hospital for a couple of days. We came back home and then we were all in the pandemic together. So it was a year-long experience of my then three-year-old, who just turned five yesterday, as it happens, and a newborn, and nobody was sleeping, and everybody was grumpy, and then, of course, you were staying away from everyone. So it was a difficult experience, to say the least. I haven't slept well in about 2 years now, but, you know, so glad that we have two daughters who are doing really well, who are just incredible human beings, and pleased, too, to have the privilege to raise them.
Sure, that's awesome. So I guess as a way to begin, may I invite you to read from your novel? But before you read, I think, would it be okay just to give our listeners just a synopsis of the novel and which section you're going to be reading from, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. So I'm reading from my novel. It's called A Particular Kind of Black Man. It's about a child who is born in Utah, which is a state in the western part of the United States. His parents are from Nigeria. I'm reading from the beginning of the book. The book is more or less talking about his parents' experience coming to the States from Nigeria and how difficult their initial few months, I guess you could say, in America is. And the book itself is about a young child and then man who is trying to figure out who he is. He's trying to construct an identity. And the book is about how fraught that journey is. So I'll just read a few pages and then I look forward to talking. She told me I could serve her in heaven. She accompanied me to school each day. School was about a mile away and a few hundred feet into my trek, just as my family's apartment building drifted out of view behind me. She would appear at my side. I don't remember how she looked. Memory often summons a generic figure in her place. An elderly white woman with frizzled gray hair, slightly bent over, a smile featuring an assortment of gaps and silver linings. I do remember her touch, however. It felt cool and papery, disarmingly comfortable on the hottest days of fall. She would often pat my head as we walked together, and a penetrating silence would cancel the morning sounds around us. I felt comfortable, protected somehow in her presence. She never walked all the way to school with me, but her parting words were always the same. Remember, if you are a good boy here on earth, you can serve me in heaven. I was 5 years old. Her words sounded magical to me, vast and alluring. I didn't know her. I barely knew her name, but the offer she held out to me each morning seemed far too generous to dismiss lightly. In class, I would think about what servitude in heaven would be like. I imagined myself carrying buckets of water for her on streets of gold, rubbing her feet as angels sang praises in the background. I imagined that I'd have my own heavenly shack. I'd have time to do my own personal heavenly things as well. How else would I get to heaven? One day I told my father about her offer. We were talking about heaven, a favorite subject of his, And I mentioned that I already had a place there. I've already found someone to serve, I said. What do you mean? Dad smiled warmly at me. I felt his love. I repeated myself. Daddy, I'm going to heaven. And how are you going to get there? I told him about the old lady, my heavenly shack, the streets of gold. My father stared at me a moment, grief and sadness surging briefly to the surface of his face, and then anger. He leaned forward, stared into my eyes. Listen to me now. The only person you will serve in heaven is God. You will serve no one else. My father has told me many times that he settled in Utah because he didn't want to be where anyone else was. His cousins and siblings had left Nigeria for Athens, London, Rome, New York City, and Houston. My father wanted to be an American, but he also craved isolation, so he decided he would travel to a city in America he knew nothing about. He left Nigeria in 1979 after a school in Utah, Weber State University, offered him a place in its mechanical engineering program. His bride, my mother, accompanied him. They arrived in a country that bore little resemblance to the country they expected. Dad, a devout fan of television shows like Gunsmoke and Bonanza, was disappointed when he discovered that cowboy hats were no longer in style, and he sadly stowed his first American purchase, a brown 10-gallon hat that he bought during a layover in Houston, in his suitcase and under his bed. Mom arrived in America expecting peace and love. She had fallen for the music of the Beatles and the Beach Boys as a high school student in Lagos while listening to the records that her businessman father brought back from his trips abroad. Though she had imagined a country where love conquered all, where black people and white people lived together in peace and harmony, Mom and Dad arrived, instead, in a place where there were no other black people for miles around, a place dominated by a religion they never heard of before. But this was America, and they were in love. They moved into a small apartment in Ogden, Utah, and started a family. I came first in 1981, and my brother followed in 1983. Dad attended his classes during the day while Mom took care of us at home. Occasionally, she explored the city while pushing my brother and me along in a double stroller. Soon enough, we were all walking hand in hand. At night, my parents held each other close and spoke their dreams into existence. They would have more children. My father would start a business. They would become wealthy. They would send their children to the best schools. They would have many grandchildren. They would build their own version of paradise on a little slip of desert in a country that itself was a dream, a place that seemed impossible until they stepped off the plane, shielding the sun from their eyes, and saw for themselves the expanse of land that my father had idly pointed to on a fading map many years before.
Thank you so much, Tope. And what a beautiful opening. Like, what an exquisite opening. You know, at the heart of this project, at the heart of your project are questions of identity and reality, the construction of reality and memory, I guess, to some extent. And we'll dig deeper into those questions. But the thing that sprang to mind, or rather the word that sprang to mind as you were reading there, is damaged. You know, like the kind of damage the society does to this little boy. It's also really moving how the father tries to shield him from it. Tunde is his name. They're also the only black family in the neighborhood. And a few pages later, one of Tunde's classmates is shocked that his blackness won't come off his skin. So I guess I wanted to ask you two questions. One is if you could speak about your early years in Utah and the kind of inheritance that left you with. And secondly, since you're a father yourself, how that experience, if at all, has shaped you as a father. What are the things that you're sensitive to, the things that you're aware of?
Yeah, no, those are really, really great questions. I think in response to your first question, I would say my childhood in Utah was difficult. And I think it's partly because I had no idea how to be. I didn't know who I was, and I didn't know how to get there. And I, you know, the more I think about this, it seems to me that, you know, the kind of difference, for example, between my parents and me is that my parents grew up with a sense of culture, a sense of place. You know, I think of it as if they had been handed a kind of identity card upon birth. You know, their parents handed them a card that said, you know, you are Nigerian. In my father's case, you are Yoruba. This is who your people are. This is what expected of you. And as you get older, you can decide, well, these are, you know, there are certain parts of the culture that I like and I will, you know, sort of maintain, and other parts that perhaps don't work for me. But at least you have that foundation. In my case, I grew up and my parents handed me a card that said, you're Nigerian. That didn't necessarily make sense in that American context because I was born and raised in America. And then the people I encountered oftentimes didn't know what to make of me at all. On the rare occasion that they did, they would hand me a card that said, you're an African-American. I had no idea what an African-American was. I'd met a couple, but I didn't know them nearly well enough to have a sense of their cultural kind of background and heritage and everything else. So I was just in an incredibly difficult position of having to construct an identity before I knew what that was. And so I think if I have from that moment in my life, or that I've maintained from that moment, it's me kind of inverting what initially had been a kind of terror, you know, like, I don't know who I am, and that's horrible, and I feel placeless, and I feel lost, and making that kind of sight of opportunity. Now I have the opportunity to construct a self that aligns with the person I am inside. And I think that is, in its own way, an incredible opportunity and even privilege. And I can say this, you know, I'm, I guess, 34, 35 years removed from where Tunde is at the beginning of the book. And so I have constructed an identity that I think matches the person I am inside. And I think for that reason, I feel a sense of calm and purpose, because I'm not having to kind of grapple with these questions about who I am. I've done the meticulous work of constructing itself. And so for me, that has been an edifying and, I would say, even incredibly useful experience. To respond to your second question, I'm obsessed with, sort of thinking about this in the context of my position as a father. So I'm of two minds. One, I don't want my kids to grow up with that sense of kind of existential terror that was a prominent feature of my childhood, just because I don't think that's a really healthy place to be for an extended period of time. That said, I do want them to have the opportunity to construct their own selves that aren't imposed from above, that aren't sort of imposed by society or their parents or anyone else. I want them to have the option of saying, this is the person I am, and I'm standing proudly in that. And so the path that I think my wife and I are on is to ensure that they have a foundation of, you know, stability and love and a secure household, you know, that whenever they leave, they know there's a place they can return to. But also to kind of encourage them to pursue their interests and their desires and everything else, and to empower them to do that, and to teach them how to reckon with the world. You know, another thing I think about a lot with my daughters is just ensuring that they love themselves, because that's not something I didn't love myself when I was growing up. Again, that was a pretty unfortunate place to be. I've been thinking recently that I've, in some ways, kind of replicated the experience that I had growing up for my children, which is to say that we are growing up in a neighborhood that's more diverse than the neighborhood I grew up in, but it's not a kind of predominantly Black environment. And so I've been thinking, too, about, you know, where to raise them if Washington, D.C. continues to make sense for our family. And those are questions that I'm sure will resolve in the near future. But my primary responsibility, I think, now is to sort of provide them with a place of contentment and love and warmth, to kind of listen to them, to, you know, when it's appropriate, follow the lead. You know, if they have some kind of interest or ambition that they express, you know, to take it seriously and see where it goes, and to just be there for them as well.
Thank you so much for opening up to that extent. Thank you, Tope. I think my next question, I guess we're going back to the beginning again. May I ask you just to share a little bit about your beginnings as a writer, and when did you start writing, and did you immediately gravitate towards prose, or were you interested in other forms like drama or poetry? And I guess there's a second question to that, which is, would you be able to talk to us about the genesis of this particular project? And I've got another question related to that. This is three questions in one. Forgive me.
The best but kind. No.
But for the longest time, I think the working title for this project was The Proximity of Distance. At what point did it switch to a particular kind of Black man, and why that switch? So there's three questions there.
Yeah. I will say to the first question, my start as a writer, it's always interesting to answer this question, because I suppose if I answered this question as thoroughly as I wanted to, I could go all the way back to childhood. But I will say that when I arrived at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, which is an all-male, predominantly Black school in Atlanta, I had this sort of obsession with reading. And I loved reading fiction. I was especially enthralled to kind of the massive fantasy epics and science fiction epics. And when I arrived at college, the first two or three days I was there, I was reading the Wheel of Time series by Robert Jordan, and I wasn't doing much of anything else. And so I think it was night three that I said, okay, if I'm going to be a serious student, I need to stop doing this. And so I had this kind of personal ceremony where I threw away the books and then I sat down at my desk and I wrote down a list of 10 things I wanted to achieve by the end of my college career. And I pasted that on the wall. And then I wrote down a list of 10 things I'd have to give up in order to achieve those 10 things. And at the top of the list was stop reading fiction, because I had the sense that I was in a place by myself where, you know, my parents weren't sort of, you know, looking over my shoulder. And I had the sense that if I didn't discipline myself, that I would lose myself in a world of literature, I suppose. And for some reason, at that point in my life, that seemed scary. I think partly because I thought I need to provide for myself. My parents aren't in a position to help me financially. And so I'm responsible not only for myself, but in some ways, perhaps for the rest of my family as well. And so for my college career, I didn't read that much. You know, I found a way to read some fiction. I'd taken a political science class, for example, I'd read 1984 or something, or I'd read work that was associated with, you know, political movements and that sort of thing. But I consciously stayed away from engaging with literature as much as I wanted to. So when I got to Oxford, the first thing I thought was, like, I'm free. I have all this time and space. And so I embarked on this project of reading as much as I could. I read a bunch of first novels by some of my favorite writers. I read a lot of drama. I read a lot of Harold Pinter, Arthur Miller, Shoinka. Just read a lot of drama. Kennedy as well, Adrian Kennedy. I read all kinds of stuff. And then by the time I ended my time at Oxford, I started writing this novel that was not, you know, looking back, a very good novel. At the time, I was convinced it was incredible. And I wrote as much as I could, and I finished it. And, you know, I didn't really send it around, but I just was satisfied that I'd finished something. But I noticed that a lot of my favorite writers had written poetry before, or were working poets. And I didn't have much love for poetry, but I thought, if I want to write like them, I have to start reading poetry. And so I started reading poetry, and then I became obsessed with poetry. And now I'm working at Google in London. And I left Google partly to become a poet, because I'd read so much poetry and written so much poetry. So I started writing poetry for years and years. For 2 years, sent my poems around. Nobody accepted my poems. And so I went back to prose as a compromise. And my first piece of prose was published in 2012, a story called Miracle. And that's the story that won the Kane Prize. So that's how my writing career started. I guess I've kind of answered your second question in that first response. I love poetry, and poetry is incredibly important to me. I try to start every day by reading poetry just because it centers me. And it's a really critical part of my practice, even though I'm not sort of formally writing poetry now. I think I have a really intense and intimate relationship with words as a result of my 2-year-long engagement with poetry. It's proven to be, I think, the most useful an important part of my, I guess you could call it, years of apprenticeship, if you will. Again, looking back, deeply grateful that I took that initiative to kind of engage with poetry, and also grateful that there was a kind of 18-month period when I came to DC after working at Google when I was unemployed. And I was desperate at that time and really sad, but you turned that crisis into an opportunity. I read as much as I could, watched as many films as I could, went to the museums here in DC as often as I could. And that process of filling my mind up with art has also proven to be quite, I think, useful for me. Answer to your third question. Yes, for many years, it was called the proximity of distance. I took that line from a poet that I was obsessed with at the time. I believe her name is Anna Kamienska. I think that's her name. Anyway, I was reading some poems of hers, or maybe they're more aphorisms, in Poetry Magazine, and I came across that line and loved it. I thought it kind of described my project perfectly. And so for much of the life of the book, it was called The Proximity of Distance. And the weekend before the book was about to go off to the press, the editor of my publishing house, Simon & Schuster, emailed my editor and me and said that that title didn't make sense, and he wanted us to come up with another title. And so we spent the weekend exchanging emails. This is my editor and me, taking phrases from the book or any other thing that came to mind. And it was actually Sunday night that he sent me the phrase, A Particular Kind of Black Man. And the moment I saw it, I instantly knew that was the title. And so I said, let's go. We sent it to the head of the publishing house and he agreed. And so the book went off to the presses with a new title.
Thank you. And I'm quite curious about the novel that's stalled, or the one that's still in your drawer somewhere, which will be published posthumously, and this project, A Particular Kind of Black Man, like, what is the difference between the two projects, right? And then secondly, the structure of A Particular Kind of Black Man, like, is really fascinating. And how did you arrive at that structure? Could you tell us about the writing of this project as well?
Absolutely. First, my first novel, which I haven't thought about, to be honest, in years and years, it was more of a kind of science fiction epic. I think I would call it like a piece of Afrofuturism, or whatever the appropriate term is now. I've heard there's some back and forth about whether that's the term that we ought to be using. But that, I think it was in that vein. I was writing a book about Africa circa like 2100, and Africa had become a kind of united continent, and there was a royal family. It was this very sort of involved thing. And to be honest, I think I didn't have the ability to kind of hold so many pieces together at that point. You know, I think there were probably stretches of it where the prose is okay, but I needed to do a lot of work in terms of finding my voice, in terms of becoming much better at craft, in terms of thinking and looking at structure. And it was partly because of, you know, as I was writing this, I became intimately aware of the gaps in my development as an artist that I, first of all, as I said before, started reading and writing poetry because I knew my prose needed to get better. I was completely enraptured with the prose of people. Like, you know, for example, reading Dennis Johnson's work, I am among the hordes of people who read Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson and was completely kind of changed by it in a way. And in his prose in particular, I just found very beautiful. And so reading, you know, lots of prose like that, prose that was inflected with and infused with poetry became important to me. But I also started to think a lot about structure because I wasn't able to, I just didn't know how to structure a story or a novel. And I started diagramming stories just to get a sense of how structure worked in short stories. And I also started diagramming novels. And I read a lot of short story collections and read a lot of novels and diagrammed the structures in those. And I became obsessed with structure and thinking about structure. And so to answer your second question, I wanted to write a book that paid homage to a lot of the story collections that I liked. I like story collections that are adventurous in terms of point of view, story collections that feature, say, a first-person story, a second-person story, a third-person story. The thing that I like about those collections is that, especially if, you know, the collection is focused on one character, say, and you get a second person story and a third person story in addition to that first person story, you get different vantage points. And I thought, what if I write a book in which, you know, you have first and second and third person, but it's all tied into the narrative, which is to say, I'm not doing it just to do it, as you often see in collections, but that, you know, kind of moving to a second person is a critical component of the narrative, not just to show that I can do it, but because the character himself is having a second person moment. And then I thought, okay, how can I have a third person moment in a novel if the bulk of the novel has been in first person? What, from a plot perspective, would make the novel go in that direction? And so that became an interesting challenge for me. And I think when I was thinking about structure, I started reading a book that is, you know, one of my favorite books, In a Strange Room by Damon Galgut. And I just was obsessed with what he was doing with point of view in that book, a kind of seamless transition from one POV to the next. I think I read that book 3 or 4 times over the course of a couple months because I just felt like he had a lot to teach me about how to do that. And I think In a Strange Room is also a work of autofiction, if I'm not mistaken. I think I just learned a lot about craft from that book and other books that I encountered. And I wanted to do my own part to kind of ask and perhaps even answer the question about what the novel can do in the 21st century, because that's a question that I'm obsessed with and continue to be obsessed with. So this was my sort of initial engagement with that question.
Tope, I kid you not, I nearly jumped out of my seat because I was actually going to read your passage from In a Strange Room. I had it lined up later on, so thank you very much. But I might as well just read it to you and then just invite you to respond and then we'll slip back into the conversation.
Sure.
So this is what he writes. And I thought about this particular quote because, again, it's about memory and also Tunde's kind of how he moves around quite a lot. But anyway, the quote reads, "A journey is a gesture inscribed in space. It vanishes even as it's made. You go from one place to another place and onto somewhere else again. And already behind you, there is no trace that you were ever there. The roads you went down yesterday are full of different people now. None of them knows who you are. In the room you slept in last night, a stranger lies in the bed. Dust covers over your footprints. The marks of your fingers are wiped off the door. From the floor and table, the bits and pieces of evidence that you might have dropped are swept up and thrown away, and they never come back again. The very air closes behind you like water, and soon your presence, which felt so weighty and permanent, is completely gone. things happen only once and are never repeated, never return, except in memory.
Oh, wow. I mean, he deserves what he's getting. It's an incredible piece of prose. And the confidence of it as well. And I mean, it's kind of deceptively simple. I mean, I think he has an extraordinary facility with image, as evidenced by his careful use of analogy, like water, you know, the air closing up behind you like water. Again, something that seems simple, but is used so precisely in what you just read, that it opens up sort of all kinds of associations and ways of thinking about what he's saying. And also the way that the rhythm of the prose as well. He knows when to kind of use the period and when not to, right, is one way of putting it. So that even, and you're an excellent reader, and I think this kind of adds to the effect. But it's a kind of calming. It feels almost like waves lapping against a shore in a way, the way he writes. I think that's what, I think if you're interested in the craft of writing or the craft of fiction, you want to get to a place of mastery where the prose feels that way. It has a kind of rhythmic pulse that moves through you. Because one of the magic, one of the wonders, I guess you could say, the magical things about prose is that the writer has a rhythm in her mind or his mind as she's composing a paragraph or a story or a novel. And then they put it out into the world. And somebody, and you know, I don't know him, never had the pleasure of meeting him, but there's something that, there's a kind of communication that he and I have, because the rhythm that he has placed into the book, has placed into the very sort of fiber of the prose is still there. So that when I pick up the book and read it, we're having this kind of rhythmic conversation across time and across geography as well. And that's the thing that I love about fiction. That's what I love about art in general, but in particular about fiction and prose. You know, you're reminding me that I haven't read the book in quite a while. I need to go back and engage with it. That's beautiful stuff right there.
No, and thank you again. And actually leads to my next question, which is that A Particular Kind of Black Man is a work of autofiction. Two parts to the question is, one is, what is it about autofiction that appealed to you? Since we've established that you started as a science fiction writer and then you've pivoted into this direction. And I'm also curious to find out about the response of your family or the people that close to you, like your father and your brothers, how they responded to the project.
Yeah. So when I started writing the book, I wasn't sure what I was writing, to be honest. I thought I was writing a memoir. I had no idea how to start a book, you know, how to get into a book. And so what I thought to myself was, I'll just write from my life and try to make it compelling and try to translate all these feelings I have inside myself to the page and hope that something of the kind of vitality and anger and wonderment of it all manages to find its way to the page. And I started from that perspective. I think a couple things influenced me. One, I was so hungry for knowledge about how to become a writer that I was watching a bunch of videos on YouTube where writers talk about craft. And almost all of them said the same thing about the act of writing and trying to create a novel and create characters, which is that over time, characters begin to assume a life of their own, that, you know, they would go to sleep and the characters would be speaking to them, or they'd be going about their day, running errands, and the characters would be imposing themselves in certain ways on their lives. And I thought, this sounds like a bunch of mumbo jumbo to me. Like, I just want to know how to write and how to write as beautifully as you do. What I discovered is that I continued to write, that Tunde began to do things that I hadn't done and have thoughts that I don't recall having. And so that's when I began to kind of have a sense that maybe I was writing a work of fiction. The second thing that happened is that I was reading a book by David Shields called Reality Hunger, which some people think about as maybe the kind of opening text, if you will, or the text that inspired a bunch of writers who then began to write autofiction. And he just kind of, he writes about a lot of things that I was feeling. One, his sense that the contrivance of plot had become for him as a reader and a writer as well, just kind of boring and monotonous, you know? And I felt the same way as well. Like, there's something about stories, some stories, not all by any stretch, but a lot of stories that feels like very constructed. And for that reason, very synthetic. And I wanted something in my reading experience and as a writer as well that felt vibrant on the page. You know, like reading a book where all the parts fit so perfectly. You have the setup and then there's the rising action, there's the climax and then the denouement and all that stuff. And I was like, I kind of know. It's the experience, for example, of going to a movie and knowing all the beats in the movie, even if you haven't seen the movie before. If you've seen enough movies, you kind of know where it's going to go and how what'll happen to the protagonist and what'll happen to the friend of the protagonist, the love interest and all that stuff. And so I thought, is it possible to do something outside of these boundaries that have been established by, you know, storytellers, many of them incredibly talented, but these kind of structures they've set up for us, is there any way to kind of escape? And so I think reading that book kind of empowered me to kind of figure out what I could do and to think of this as, again, a way of innovating in the world of fiction. My family, as it happens, I'm not sure if my parents have read the book. I don't think they have. I don't think my sibling, I know one sibling has read the book. I am, I suppose you could say, the black sheep in my family because I'm the one who's obsessed with literature and my siblings aren't really, nor are my parents. My dad did read an excerpt from the novel at one point. He said, I liked it, but it was interesting. He said, some of those things didn't happen. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I was writing a story and I wanted the story to be compelling. And so there are certain things that, you know, as a writer, you amplify and other things that you ignore or de-emphasize. And so that was his response to it. Maybe he thought I was writing directly from my life. But that's not something that maybe that's a kind of luxury. I don't necessarily think about how they might react just because I know that they're not as keen and obsessed with literature as I am.
Thank you for that. I have maybe three or four more questions, but since you mentioned your father, I thought maybe we could just talk about him for a moment, if that's okay. Because as you've mentioned, like one of the themes that threads through this book is about the construction of reality, right? Like Tunde is very drawn to wrestling as a young person, like even from very early on, the mother's illness distorts reality. Then there's also the fictions that people live in. And one of those fictions that's really important to this book is the American dream, right? The fiction of the American dream. And I just want to jump to, I hope I'm not committing some kind of literary crime here, but to an essay that you, because I don't want to keep conflating Tope and Tunde. Those are two different characters.
It's fine. Conflate away.
There's an essay that you wrote recently titled Fragile Freedom. And I just wanted to read a paragraph there and then maybe you can then speak to us about the fiction of the American dream, and it's about your dad. You write that in the summer, my father stopped cleaning trailers and sold ice cream instead. Every now and then, he drove long miles to deliver packages for various corporations, but his trailer cleaning business was the one constant. After a few months of accompanying my father to work, I no longer associated life outside with freedom. Even when I played basketball in the sun with my brothers and friends, I knew my leisure had been sponsored in part by my father's labor. What I sensed but could not express, not quite, was that the fun times I spent outside were a kind of illusion, that beneath the sheen of sun and laughter was our grimy reality, a kind of purgatory that my family, and only my family, it seemed, had to endure. I admired my father for his boundless energy and incredible work ethic, for the fact he never paused to rest or even catch his breath. But we all saw how red his eyes were, or how difficult it was for him just to lift his legs into and out of his car. I had no desire to spend my life doing the same.
Yes. You know, I drew a lot of my book from the experience of watching my father trying to survive and provide a life for his family. And I think, like I wrote in that essay, that became a motivating factor for me in terms of, you know, sort of trying to do well in school and try to pursue a life of the mind, I suppose. And also, I also had deep admiration and respect for him and how hard he worked. And my thinking was, what if I worked that hard as he worked, in a kind of artistic context or academic context? Because my father is an incredibly intelligent and charismatic person. But for various reasons, he wasn't able to live the life that he wanted to live. And among those reasons are racism and, you know, associated evils. And so I have the great privilege of being able to kind of live his life as well, in a way, if that makes any sense. You know, I am able to kind of do the things that he wanted to do, which is the major thing is to kind of to freely pursue the things that I want to pursue, which is all that my dad wanted, and he wasn't able to do that. So he definitely is in the back of my mind all the time as I'm writing or going to work or doing whatever it is that I'm doing. I want to honor his sacrifice. I want to honor his hard work. And I want to honor, too, his belief in me and the fact that he gave up so much to come to America. And, you know, the thing that's also, I think, sort of incredible about him and sad as well is that I think at a certain point in his adulthood, maybe when he was the age that I am now, he kind of figured that he wouldn't be able to do certain things. And so he poured himself into us, his children, and he provided us with all kinds of ideas and advice about how to be. And he ensured that we were all disciplined human beings and that we would have the discipline to achieve the things we wanted to achieve. And I'm thinking now, like, I have all kinds of ambitions and dreams at this point, and how I'm thinking how devastating it would be to kind of either jettison those ambitions and dreams or just place them aside and decide, okay, well, it's not going to work out for me. Let me invest in the next generation because this is the generation that will be able to do something. And so I think all the time about that sacrifice. And that's why I think I take, you know, my craft so seriously and why I take my work seriously and the act of being a father as well so seriously.
Thank you so much for that. Coming back to autofiction, you're someone who's written incredible essays about the architecture of publishing in the US, or you're somebody that thinks very deeply about how people are read, and in particular, how Black artists, Black writers are read. And the two essays, I guess, that I'm thinking of, even just like as I'm sitting here, are Against Accessibility, which was published in the LA Review of Books, and most recently, at sort of a piece that was published this time last year, I think, in Lit Up, Can a Black Novelist Write Autofiction? And the preoccupation in both essays is how Black writers are read in what you call Western literary landscape dominated by white editors, white critics, and white readers. And regarding autofiction, you write that writers of color are sparingly featured in appraisals of autofiction. And I just wanted you to expand on that, if it's okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for reading those essays. I appreciate it. And I, you know, I think that the thing that is frustrating for me is that I don't think, you know, again, this Western landscape that's dominated by white editors and white readers and white publicists and everything else, I'm not sure that they're looking to writers of color for innovation. You know, so the thing that's happened now is that there are obviously many writers of colors who are incredibly prominent. They're major players on the international literary stage, if you will. And that's happened. But I think critics, the kind of people who, the priests of literature, if you will, people who decide who's holy and who isn't, who's worthy of praise and attention and who isn't. I think, and I don't think this is intentional, but I think their sense is that the people who will actually move the state of literature forward are mostly white writers, right? So that even as libraries around the world begin to feature writers of color and bookshops are featuring more writers of color, if you go into the inner sanctum of literature, you know, some of these journals, you know, either it's the, in the States, it would be places like the New Yorker or the New York Review of Books and those sorts of things. The people who are writing about literature have it in their minds that that the people who are going to continue to innovate and create a space for fiction in our culture in the future are mostly white writers. And for me, that's like infuriating. And there are, and as I note in that piece that you cited, there are a couple writers of color who are, you know, sort of elevated by these critics. People like, for example, Teju Cole, who is, I think, a wonderful writer. Zadie Smith also comes to mind. But it happens the same way in like every industry, which is that, you know, like you'll have gatekeepers who say, okay, there's one or two of you who are like sort of worthy, but the rest of you just stay out there. I wanted to note that one reason I think that someone like, for example, Teju, who again, I would emphasize, I think writes beautiful prose, but I think that he has this incredible grounding in a Western kind of high art tradition. For me, it's akin to being, I know because I've been this kid in class, it's like being the Black kid in an all-white classroom, and you're wanting to prove to the teacher and everyone else that you're smart. And one way you do that is by, you know, knowing a lot about the stuff they value. So if it's a class about American history, you know, the teacher's talking, you raise your hand, you're able to recite from memory, you know, some portion of an important speech, or you're able to kind of cite, you know, sort of certain historical moments. And then everybody will look at you like, wow, he must be smart because he knows this stuff. Whereas if you raised your hand and said, oh, there was this great musician in Nigeria who did all these things, or here's what happened in South, you know, sort of South African history or Zimbabwean history, they'll roll their eyes and keep it moving. And one thing I wanted to do in the book was that I wanted to privilege like sort of Black cultural experiences, you know, kind of thumbing my nose at that. You know, there's one reason why, who was one of the most important artists for me when I was growing up, Lauryn Hill. So that's why Lauryn Hill has pride of place in my book. That's why I talk a lot about, you know, sort of Black musicians from the 70s and 80s. That's why I try to feature Black ideas, even if I'm not sort of platforming Black thinkers. I was playing around with the idea of double consciousness, for example. Not one critic mentioned that. I thought that was like a kind of really obvious thing that was happening in my book. You know, Du Bois's notion of double consciousness, and no critic that I encountered interrogated that. And so I think that's just what happens when you have gatekeepers who will read, you know, out of a sense, I suppose, of like liberalism, will engage with certain books, but don't look to those books as the future of literature. And I just wanted to kind of, again, interrogate that, and to the extent that I can, insert myself into that conversation as well.
I think you inserted yourself very beautifully. This is a conversation that could, like, there's so much that I want to ask you, like even the cover image, the artist on the cover, how that relates to the book. Like, there's just, yeah, there's just so much. But this is a project that has been long in the making. And so in what ways did it change you as an artist? How did it change you working on this project? Because I guess there are parts which are really heartbreaking to read, you know, and like revisiting some of those memories or episodes. I'm thinking in particular in relation to your mom. And so in what ways did this project change you as an artist? And then secondly, what did you hope to give? I think you'd started answering that question in your last answer, like, but what did you want to give to the world with this particular project? And what have you given to the world?
I'll answer all questions. Cover. I love art. I spend a lot of time looking at art and thinking about visual art, I should say, and at the museum. And I have a friend. She represents a number of artists. And so I was looking at some of the art that she's representing. And I saw this image by an artist named, I think his name is Admire Camus Zangarere. I just loved his images, you know, these kind of seemingly pencil sketched images of a man. And I thought like that would be the perfect kind of image to adorn the cover of my book, because the sketch isn't filled in, but you can make out the face, you can make out the expression. And it looks like it's a person in the process of becoming. That was my thought anyway, when I saw the image. And so I submitted the image to my editor and said, hey, I'd love this to be on the cover of my book. And he said, well, this is unconventional because generally the publishing house decides what's on the cover of the book, but I'll send it around and see what we can do. And I didn't hear anything about it for 6 months. I thought they had sort of decided not to do it. And then he emailed me the cover and he said, what do you think about this? And I was just so impressed, and I loved the cover. And I later saw some of the other versions that they had been working on. And this cover, I'm so glad it's the cover, and I think it fits the book really well. How did the book change me? It changed me in all kinds of ways. I think in order to write a book, the thing I discovered is that you have to submit yourself fully to the process. I'd initially thought of myself as the person who was, you know, sort of the grandmaster kind of god. I was responsible for trying to put all the pieces in place and make sure all the pieces worked the way they were supposed to. And I learned over the course of writing it that what actually happens, I think if you want the book to become the book it's meant to be, is that the book needs to work on you as well. And now I've become one of those writers who's speaking in what many people might think is mumbo jumbo, but it's true, at least in my case. Like, the book has to work on you, enter your consciousness, kind of assert itself and, you know, sort of assert the way it wants to be in the world. And that's what I discovered with this book, you know. And for me, it was kind of becoming a better listener internally, succumbing to those ideas, and also kind of being fearless. Because as I began to grapple with some of the ideas that I wanted to take on, I thought like, well, will this work? You know, will I be published by anyone? Will critics take this seriously because I'm not hewing to the conventional path? I'm not doing what it is I'm supposed to be doing, at least what I think I'm supposed to be doing. And then over time, I just thought, well, this is the book. This is the way I want the book to be in the world. So, you know, I'll go for it and see what happens. And I feel so blessed that at least one editor saw my ambitions and what I was trying to do and took the book on and the house published it. So I'm grateful for that. And in terms of what I gave to the world, I think if somebody cornered me and asked me to say, you know, what is the kind of central theme of your book? I would say the central theme is that reality is constructed. And that's what my character comes to recognize. And I think if you read the book a certain way at the end, and I hope I'm not committing a literary sin here by describing the end of my book, but at this point, I want the reader to leave with two impressions. One, that everything they've just read, especially at the end of the book, could be a figment of Tunde's imagination, but that doesn't matter because he still gets what he needs from that experience, right? There's one way of reading the text in which, you know, the stuff that happens at the end is basically him trying to sort himself out. He's sitting at his desk in college and he's writing, you know, what would it be like if I reconnected with this really important person? And part of what I'm arguing is that even if it takes place in his mind, that it's still meaningful, that he's still, as long as he's still feeling certain things, as long as he still has that sense of catharsis that he's been searching for his entire life, that it's still a meaningful experience. Because we have a really kind of odd and constricted way of thinking about reality in the West. Either reality is here and it's substantive and it's something that I can touch, or it's nothing at all. And I think what Tunde is beginning to discover is that in order to survive, and I would argue this is the case for many people of color and women and other marginalized communities, in order to survive, we need to construct new realities, because the realities that we inhabit were not constructed for our benefit. Right. And so that if you want to survive and thrive in this constructed reality, you have to change essential parts of yourself. And that is a compromise that we shouldn't have to make. And part of what I'm arguing for is that maybe, especially in this century, what would happen if we constructed new realities where people like us could thrive and not, we would not have to compromise sort of basic fundamental aspects of ourselves. And so that's what Tunde has done. He says, what would happen if I constructed a reality where someone like me can thrive? What would that look like? And the book is his response to that question.
Thank you so much, Tope. Thank you so much. And I find it so moving that the last word in the novel is home. And this coming from a character who at the beginning almost can't look at himself in the mirror. I find that transformation so moving. And now we're going to ask you to read something in honor of the imprisoned writer Selahattin Demirtaş from Turkey.
So the notion that there, you know, are writers who are imprisoned for being writers is just something that is tragic and deeply unsettling and frankly unacceptable. And so as I was thinking about Selahattin's case, and I thought of a poem that I have returned to again and again in my life, a poem that has been incredibly meaningful to me over many years. It's a poem called Love After Love, and it's by Derek Walcott. I'll read it now. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life.
Hello. Thank you, Tope. Thank you so much. Eh?
Thank you. That was an incredible interview. I really appreciate the care with which you read my novel and those essays. It's really meaningful to me.
Thank you. And thank you for a wonderful book again.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation. Thank you to Bongani and to Tope for this beautiful and scintillating dialogue. This episode was produced by Andre Burnett. Thanks to our intern, Lwando Mfundisi, and our project coordinator, Lara Buxbaum. To Penn South Africa board members, Kate Hyman and Yewanda Ematozo, and the whole of the board. And thanks to Amy Balmolowski, Jehan Jones-Drogowski for their support. Join us again next week for The Empty Chair, a transatlantic conversation. If you want more information about our work on protecting freedom of expression and free speech and our solidarity with imprisoned writers across the globe, please visit www.pensouthafrica.co.za. This podcast series is funded by a grant from the US Embassy in South Africa to promote open conversation and highlight shared histories. The podcast lineup is determined by Penn South Africa, and the views expressed by our participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the policies of the United States government. Thank you so much for listening.